morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network for this Wednesday, the 21st of March. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about resistance to antibiotics. The World Health Organization has issued another warning about this week. Resistance is emerging as a very large problem all over the world, actually. And the World Health Organization is warning that antibiotics soon will not be able to combat a number of serious infections like tuberculosis, strep throat, E. coli, AIDS. Why is this happening all over the world, and what can we do to prevent it? Are we going to need a whole new strain of antibiotics to combat some of these diseases? We, this hour, will be talking about this important issue with Dr. Dennis Mackey, professor of medicine and head of the infectious disease section at UW Hospital and Clinics. I would imagine we'll have quite a few phone calls on the issue. The number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Dr. Mackey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Why has this become a problem all over the world?
I think that the day antibiotics started to become available, which is now a little about 60 years ago, antibiotics first became available with penicillin in the late 1940s. And in the 1950s, one new antibiotic after another came on the scene. And by the 1970s, we had over 25 or 30 different classes of antibacterials, and we had multiple anti-tuberculous drugs, and we were starting to get the first antivirals, and we had good antifungals. And during that era of having more and more good antibiotics, it was sort of a heady time. The thought that nobody had to die of an infectious disease, we always have a magic bullet to treat them. There was nobody worried about resistance. Those who do infection control, I've been an infection control practitioner, a hospital epidemiologist for nearly 40 years, saw antibiotic resistance very early, and the infection control people in the United States were very concerned about it, and really started to implement measures to try to improve antibiotic use and to reduce the spread of resistant organisms. But it really exploded on the scene in the 1980s when MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, appeared in the scene in North America. And about the same time, Clostridium difficile, C. difficile, that causes severe colitis and can be fatal, appeared in the mid-1980s as well. And it's been nothing but a skyrocketing rates of resistance around the world. And resistance isn't just with the bacteria that cause pneumonia or sinusitis or urinary tract infections that most people think about. There's probably even more alarming resistance with huge problems in many parts of the world, such as malaria. Literally every antimalarial drug that's ever been developed, we have seen resistance develop within a matter of several years. And it's always linked to heavy use. Tuberculosis, which kills 2 or 3 million people around the world every year, and half the world are infected by the tuberculosis organism, we have very alarming resistance occurring in many parts of the world that are strains that are resistant to virtually all of the major anti-tuberculous drugs, and getting infected with one of these strains is a fatal disease. And we're seeing resistance even with antivirals now that we have, for herpes. The drugs we've used, we're starting to see resistance. So it is a phenomenon of heavy use and the potential for the resistant organisms that mutate out in response to the antibiotic therapy spreading from patient to patient. So it's two issues. Antibiotic use drives the strains to become resistant, and then these resistant strains spread person to person. And a person who's never had an antibiotic can get infected with a multi-drug resistant strain that occurs very, very commonly. So we're at a very crisis stage globally.
This is serious, isn't it?
It is, without question.
What do we do about it?
Well, I think that like anything that we have to deal with, I don't think it's a hopeless situation. And there's already pretty good evidence that if we make a commitment to what needs to be done, we can make a big difference. And if we want to drill down, the two most immediate things that need to be done are greatly restricting use of anti-infectives. Anti-infectives, whether we're talking about antibiotics, antivirals, antifungals, are precious drugs. They are a class of drugs that have probably saved more lives than any other class of drugs ever developed, more than heart drugs, neurologic drugs, GI drugs, antibiotics have saved many, literally hundreds of millions of lives over the last 50 years. But we've overused them, and we've got good guidelines now. There's pretty good consensus of when anti-infectives ought to be used in literally every clinical setting. The challenge for us is to assure that these guidelines are followed, because if they are, we know that the overall use in the population plummets. It drops very substantially. We've had restrictions on key antibiotics at university hospitals now for 30 years, and that list grows, and we're getting tougher and tougher. We have a full-time team in the hospital 24/7 that reviews every antibiotic prescription and looks, drills down, is it appropriate, is it keeping with guidelines, or are people getting a little loose? And if it's very questionable, basically the antibiotics stop. And if it's a drug that's unnecessarily broad spectrum, that drug is not allowed to be used. And we use a simpler, narrow spectrum drug that would be less prone to select for resistance. Well, this kind of approach is absolutely fundamental. And the good news is that hospitals across the United States now are really taking this seriously. And every hospital in the country now is finally having a program to try to use antibiotics much more rationally and especially more restrictively.
What about every hospital in the world?
That's another story. One of my former research fellows that worked in my research lab about 15 years ago, we've set up a consortium of hospitals in the developing world. We have about 150 hospitals where we're training people in hospital infection control in antibiotic use. And what's even more alarming is that the antibiotic resistance rates, we think that they're bad in the United States. In parts of the world, the developing world, where there's very little information on appropriate use, and there's not the resources to try to monitor use and improve use, resistance rates are two or three times higher than they are in the United States. Incredible rates of resistance in the developing world. And this consortium has been designed to try to improve antibiotic use and prevent the spread of resistant organisms. And it's made a lot of progress, but it's been easy because there's been no programs. Just even bringing in simple programs and making them work, you can see a very substantial impact. But this needs to be applied very, very widely. And you asked the penetrating question. This has not been taken very seriously in most parts of the world. It is in the developed countries, in parts of Scandinavia. If we go to the Netherlands, we go to Switzerland, they have almost no antibiotic resistance. They've had restrictive programs on use of antibiotics for 25 or 30 years. And as a consequence, they have a fraction of the resistance of the rest of the world, much less than we do, Western Europe, UK, Japan, Singapore, Australia. And the countries that have really taken it seriously, they can show much, much lower rates of resistance. And it proves that simple programs can make a difference. They need to be implemented very widely. That's going to be fundamental if we're going to make a difference.
In the meantime, do you need to come up with a whole different strain of antibiotics so you can attack?
Well, here's an alarming, this is probably why WHO sounded the alarm. And my professional society, the Infectious Diseases Society of America, has been trying to promote rational antibiotic use for 25 years. And we sounded an alarm with white papers we've written as long as 15 years ago and 10 years ago to try to improve antibiotic use, and it's helped. But that's just not enough. And here's what we're alarmed by. We've just written a white paper pointing out there's very few new drugs in the pipeline. For certain, we've had fewer and fewer new anti-infectives, which is extremely alarming. We've had one new important antimalarial that's come out and has become a major drug that's used for malaria now, but I have no question in my mind, we've already started to see resistance of that drug. There have been very few new anti-tuberculous drugs over the last 20 years. And so we've always been one step ahead of the organism, but it's now a half a step. And we still can treat the majority of infections, but I never dreamed when I started in infectious disease 40 years ago, I'd live to see the day that we have patients with resistant infections that we have no commercial antibiotics to use, where we have to get on the telephone and know that there's an experimental drug available that we can get through a company
with
CDC to treat a patient. And we're increasingly having to do that now.
Oh, my. Is it difficult for a doctor? You obviously are way on top of your game here, but is it a difficult situation for somebody in medicine to determine whether or not an antibiotic would be appropriate?
No, it's not that difficult at all. And the guidelines, our diagnostic measures are getting better and better. And when we have superior diagnostics, if I compare with where we were 40 years ago and where we are today, our diagnostics on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is nothing and 10 is you have perfect diagnostics, you can diagnose every infection 100% accurately, we're at about a 7 right now. We used to be at about a 2 or 3. But if we can get to a 9 or 10 and we're getting very sensitive molecular techniques with a sample of saliva or a sample of blood and using molecular techniques, we diagnose most of our viral infections now by detecting the DNA of the virus. We don't try and do cultures. And that practice is spreading widely. And as we get better and better diagnostics, that will implicitly reduce antibiotic use. But right now, at our 7, we've got good guidelines that perform well, that can tell a physician when they should use antibiotics. One of my children lives in Australia, and Australia has really been on top of this, and they've made a big impact in their healthcare sector on antibiotic resistance. They have national guidelines. Every physician is expected to look at the guidelines, and if a physician is using antibiotics excessively, it's easy to detect, and they see that they're not following the guidelines, they're going to pay a price. They may get penalized. They may get suspended.
Oh.
They take it very seriously, and they do not treat an ear infection in a 3-year-old child who's not very sick, doesn't have much fever, they got an earache, it's not very inflamed, they don't give antibiotics. If you have sinusitis, you've had a cold, now you've got sinusitis, I'm very congested, I've got a little bit of pus coming out of my nose, I've got a little low-grade fever. If you're a healthy adult, they don't treat it. Because the studies show that giving antibiotics, even though you think it's helping you, if you do comparative trials with no antibiotics, the benefit is very, very minimal. You maybe start to feel a lot better one day earlier, not a week or 2 weeks earlier, at most by a day of more rapid improvement. And you're paying a big price for getting antibiotics. So in many parts of the world, they're very restrictive on use of antibiotics. We are moving in that direction, but we are not yet at that level, and we need to get at that level.
And quickly, it sounds like.
Without question.
Yeah. How much of a problem is it that people are not taking antibiotics exactly as they are prescribed?
That is a potential issue, and that's a very good point, because we do know if you do have a bacterial infection, let's say you have a urinary tract infection, or you have a strep throat, you have a pneumonia. We do know that if you don't treat it optimally, you don't give a large enough dose, or you don't continue it as long as we know is needed to reliably cure the infection, that will increase the risk that resistance can occur in that person. And that does contribute, but it probably is a minor issue compared to the overuse of antibiotics. One thing that I think the public needs to understand is that antibiotics are your friend, antibiotics are your enemy, and unnecessary antibiotics are your enemy. I mean, Clostridium difficile antibiotic-associated colitis, that's only been identified and characterized for the last 25 to 30 years, it's a number one cause of death now due to hospital-acquired infections and clinic-acquired infections in the United States and North America, most of the developing countries. And it's spreading like wildfire. There's 750,000 cases of hospital-acquired or clinic-acquired Clostridium difficile antibiotic-associated diarrhea. And if you get an antibiotic that you don't need, you're putting yourself at jeopardy of a serious side effect that you wouldn't have had to do. And so if you need an antibiotic, there's a clear indication, then you should get an antibiotic, an appropriate antibiotic, as narrow spectrum as possible in accordance with guidelines. And not a day longer than is necessary. And if you don't need an antibiotic, for heaven's sake, don't push your physician to give you an antibiotic. If they're reluctant, is probably because they recognize that there's not a clear indication. And giving you an antibiotic is putting you at jeopardy. It's not helping you get better more rapidly.
Two phone calls. As you might imagine, we have a full bank going, and we're going to have a busy hour here. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Mackey, professor of medicine, head of the infectious disease section at UW Hospital and Clinics. Antibiotic resistance, a serious problem. You've heard him outline how very serious a problem it is. All over the world, a serious problem here in the United States, and we need to attack it right now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're having a hard time getting through, you can always use the email address. That's talk@wpr.org. We'll get to emails as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we just got word early this morning, Senator Russ Feingold will be joining us. His new book is While America Sleeps. He looks at institutional failures, domestic and abroad, since the 9/11 terrorist attacks and proposes steps to be taken by the government and also by individuals to ensure that the years ahead are focused on solving the international problems that threaten America. Also, we want to let you know that the WHAD Dinner for Listeners, get that mouth working, is taking place. It's going to be a lovely event. Larry Mueller and gardening expert Melinda Myers will be creating a mock garden talk radio program. It's at the Milwaukee Mitchell Park Domes, where you can go to the desert and the jungle and look at gorgeous flowers. Beautiful place. Thursday, April 5. The deadline to register is today, actually, and tickets are $40. For more information and to reserve tickets, visit WPR.org/Milwaukee. And we hope to see you there. It'll be fun. All right, two phone calls. Brad in Whiting. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. 70% of antibiotics produced in America mostly go to healthy factory farm animals, mainly to make them grow big. This causes bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. The AMA, the WHO, the CDC, Europe, they are all asking for a ban on this practice of giving antibiotics to healthy farm animals. There was a huge paper that just came out a couple weeks ago by Dr. Lance Price talking about linking MRSA strain 398 for making the jump from farmers to pigs, where then the MRSA developed the resistance, and then the resistant bug jumped from the pigs back to humans. And this is a monumental finding in medicine, linking this practice on factory farms to producing antibiotic resistance. I'd like the guests to talk about that. And before I go, I'd just like to ask the listeners to appeal to your state and federal representatives, and also Dr. Daryl Buss, the head of the UW Vet School, to try and get a ban going on this practice in the United States and in the state of Wisconsin.
All right, Dr. Mackey.
The caller is absolutely correct that there's a tremendous amount of antibiotics that are fed to animals. The first question I'd ask is why? Because very few of these animals really have an infection that needs to be treated. And the basis for this are studies that are 40, 50 years old that show that giving low doses of antibiotics in their feed tends to reduce disease, and they get to market a little earlier, maybe 10% of the time earlier, and they have less loss of food animals. And so that for farmers who work on a close margin, It's an advantage, a significant economic advantage, because when you stop and think about it, if there's any possibility that antibiotic use in animals can bring resistant organisms to humans, why on earth would we do it? And the reality of is the economic issue is what's driven it. It's very similar to the enormous use of pesticides and herbicides to maximize crop yields. And you know, it's easy to say we shouldn't do this, but it's also important to realize that we have fewer and fewer farms in America. We have 400 million people in North America to feed. We have 7 billion people globally to feed. And so the reality that large-scale farming, we're not going to put the genie back in the bottle. If we're going to feed these enormous numbers of people, we have to be able to get adequate amounts of yields on these harvests. That's why it's used. Now, that being said, I couldn't agree more fully with you. I think we do need a ban. The countries that have had a ban, one of the first countries that had a ban was Sweden, I think, and a number of small European countries had bans, but they don't raise food animals. They don't raise large amounts of food crops, so it's very easy for them to have a ban. It's not as easy in the United States, and that's why there's been resistance to have a ban. But the good news is we are moving in that direction, and we've had the first restrictions that I've seen, significant restrictions, and I think the probability is high that within 5 years, certainly 10 years, we will eliminate the use of antibiotics in animal feed. It's a very legitimate question, and what's most alarming about it is that for many years, the only linkage was enteric infections like Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter, that we know animals are the reservoir of the organism. We now know that there are other organisms such as Enterococcus and now MRSA, where there appears to be a linkage with farm animals and human infections. So I think that the pressure to restrict, eliminate, ideally, the use of antibiotics in animal feeds is very important.
Thank you so much for the call. David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Hello. That's one of the points I was going to make. Another point is, not only the antibiotics, a lot of it goes through your system. You end up pissing out a good percentage of these antibiotics, and the cattle, you know, goes into the groundwater and then, you know, get streams with all sorts of antibiotic resistance. And then just they should rest some antibiotics because it takes energy of that microbe to resist these things. And if you take the antibiotics out of use for a while, the resistance to it will diminish over time.
Dr. Mackey.
Well, we know that. That's why, as I was saying, we have very good evidence now, even in large population studies, if you successfully reduce antibiotic use by a variety of programs, there are many things that we can do in human medicine to reduce antibiotic use. And what we report on susceptibility testing from the lab, restrictions on drugs, guidelines, educational programs, monitoring, surveillance, all of these have been shown to make a difference on antibiotic use. And there's now large studies showing if you reduce antibiotic pressure significantly, if you're using, for instance, an average of 35 grams of antibiotic per 1,000 patient days, and you drop it down to 15 or 10, you can show within a year antibiotic resistance rates are dropping, and they can sometimes drop very, very substantially. Small hospitals have shown their resistance rates in one hospital just by an antibiotic control program. They can measure drops in resistance, so you're absolutely right about that.
Email from Laura in Marshfield. If we had not discovered antibiotics, would our own immune responses evolve to combat and overcome these diseases? Has our evolution in terms of our immunity slowed compared to that of harmful microorganisms, or are they becoming more dangerous because of what we created? Or would microorganisms have become stronger, faster, and become more deadly and widespread without the discovery? I ask this as someone planning to become a nurse, so I am a believer in medicine. I just wonder.
That's a very good question. And I think the answer is we know without any question that antibiotic resistance genes and every antibiotic resistance measurement in an organism, if an organism has resistance to, say, 10 different antibiotics, there's at least 10, maybe as many as 30 or 40 genes that guide that resistance. And the genes that mediate antibiotic resistance spread very rapidly and readily from organism to organism, which is an alarming thing. It's not just the spread of resistant bacteria or resistant TB, but the resistant genes can actually spread. So the question is, we've known now, we've gone into remote, studies done 40, 50 years ago, have gone into very remote areas of the world, particularly New Guinea, other areas where there have been no antibiotics ever used, and they've shown the presence of resistant organisms. So the resistant genes have probably been here for a long time. Some of them may have been selected by environmental pressure. This is very Darwinian. But resistant genes have been around for a long time. So if we had never, ever used antibiotics, if they'd never been available, we would still see some antibiotic resistance, but it'd be a very, very minimal amount. There'd be no point looking for it because you don't have the drugs to use, but I feel confident we would see people occasionally infected by resistant organisms, but it wouldn't be very much. Mm-hmm. It'd be a trivial, it'd be a fraction of what it is now. It can't be emphasized enough that antibiotic resistance is driven by what we call antibiotic pressure. The more antibiotics that's used in a population, the more likely you select out resistant mutant strains that then spread to other individuals who may not have even gotten antibiotics. So it amplifies, the antibiotic pressure amplifies the spread of resistance.
Sarah in Zion, hi.
Hi, thanks so much. I don't suppose that any studies have been done on the effectiveness of herbal antibiotics on some of the resistant strains, because I've used things like wormwood and garlic and golden seal sometimes, and they can be really effective. So I'm just curious.
It's an interesting question. First of all, a lot of people think about antibiotics, natural products and antibiotics. A lot of the antibiotics that we use are natural products. They're bacteria that have been around for millions of years, that particularly fungi, that produce antibiotics. And that's been the source of many antibiotics. So if we have a herb that has some antibiotic activity, it's no different than an antibiotic that we select from a fungus and then grow it out and make it in large amounts. Most of the over-the-counter herbal preparations have had antibacterial activity. It's very minimal, it's low grade. A good example is cranberry juice. We know that cranberry juice has some activity. It's excreted the active product in the juice. It's excreted in the urine. And studies suggest that it might help prevent urinary tract infections. But what we now know, you have to take a huge amount of cranberry juice or take tablets that have the cranberry extract to have a measurable effect on prevention of infection. Most of these herbal antibiotics are so weak, it's very questionable whether they really have any measurable impact on a true bacterial infection that needs to be treated.
We go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I know a person, you know, I have a friend of mine who's a MRSA survivor, and from a hospital, say, and I had a traumatic injury which required me to be split open like a hog at a Texas barbecue, you know, and I ended up, I feel lucky to get out of there alive, not just because of the injury, but because of, you know, her experience with MRSA. And one of the things I did read about is that I wish I could cite you the article, but it was about applying modern genetic engineering techniques to attack pathogens on a molecular level. In other words, learn how it is that TB actually attacks our system, and use genetic engineering techniques, nanotechnology, you know, and various other means of actually attacking the tuberculosis pathogen molecularly to render it ineffective. In other words, and if this is successful, I understand they're doing a lot of experimentation with this type of approach, and that evolving resistance in the normal, natural way would not be possible in this scenario.
Well, first of all, what you're describing is how we find antibiotics. We basically try to understand how a microorganism is different than a human in their metabolism and how their DNA works. And we then try to find ways of inhibiting the growth of the organism or the capacity to exhibit pathogenicity. That's what anti-infectives basically are. So that there's been very little that we would do something to prevent resistance from occurring at the molecular level. Could we do it? Very, very plausibly. I think it might be possible. There's been some modest success in giving drugs that can cause gram-negative rods to give up resistance episome, little pieces of DNA in their cytoplasm, but it's been very modest. It's eons away from ready for prime time. But on the other hand, what if we could augment the immune system? What if I have an infection, I could triple or quadruple my immune response beyond what it would normally do with and we're starting to make progress in that. We've got drugs that will enormously increase the number of white cells that are produced if you don't have enough. And they work, and in life-threatening infections, they make a difference. We use them. They're molecular drugs. They're synthetically made growth factors that stimulate the bone marrow to make many more white cells. And we have drugs that will stimulate lymphocyte production. This approach is still in its infancy, but I think there's an excellent chance that in another decade, we will have effective agents to augment immunity that would allow us to treat perhaps minor or outpatient infections without antibiotics, which would be ideal, or to augment, not have to use as much antibiotics on the inpatient setting. That's still sort of blue sky, but it's not unrealistic, and you make an excellent proposal.
Yeah. What about other things we can do to augment the immune system? It may not keep us from getting certain kinds of diseases, but it might help us in others. Are there
There's one thing that's very important we haven't talked that much about, but the control of antibiotic resistance. When we talk with our last questioner, is we're now looking at technology that can obviate the need to give antibiotics. That would be wonderful, and we're making progress in that regard. And I consider advances in technology to diagnose infection so we don't have to give an antibiotic when it's not there will enormously improve antibiotic use. Well, let me give you an example. Your little daughter is 2 years old. I mean, you love her dearly. And she now gets a temperature of 104 degrees, and she looks sick. She's very drooping. You bring her into an emergency room, and you're very, very concerned. Could she have early meningitis? Could she have a bloodstream infection that we can't identify? Maybe we ought to just put her on an antibiotic and just to play it safe. And that's what happens. That is what happens in most parts of the world. If we had a diagnostic test where we could take a drop of blood and we could say with a 99%+ certainty, there is no bacterial infection here, but this is almost certainly a viral infection that will get better on its own. We do not need to give an antibiotic. That would implicitly greatly reduce the use of antibiotics. We are making progress in that direction, and I really do believe that in 10 years, that kind of testing will be available in emergency rooms, clinics, and hospitals. That will greatly reduce antibiotic pressure right overnight, mm-hmm. once we have that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that'll make a big difference.
I mean, just simple things that you can do in your life, like running every day.
One thing that we haven't talked about is preventing the spread of resistant organisms from person to person.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who get MRSA or who get a resistant urinary tract infection with a multi-drug resistant organism, or they get multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, the organism didn't become resistant in their body. It became resistant probably, that organism may have gotten resistant 7 years ago, and has passed, made 3,000 or 4,000 passages through different patients, resistant organism passing from patient to patient to patient. Most people get infected by resistant organisms acquired from without. So hygiene is very important. Good hand hygiene is extremely important, because most of us pick up resistant germs that get into our bowel by what we eat. And you can pick up staph on your skin from contact with others who are carriers of staph. So really good hand hygiene is very, very important. 3 to 5% of the U.S. population, and it varies by subgroups, carry MRSA on their skin. 3 to 5%. That's pretty sobering.
Mm-hmm.
And if any one of those individuals has to have a big operation, we know that their risk of getting a serious, potentially catastrophic surgical site infection with the MRSA is very, very much higher than somebody who doesn't carry it. Very few people who don't carry it will get an MRSA surgical site infection. Almost all of the infections that occur in people who carry it. Well, knowing that, we've known that for about 10 years, we now screen everybody who's having a big operation for carriage of MRSA, and if they're positive, they get special bathing with antiseptics. We put a special antibiotic in their nose 3 times daily for 1 week before the surgery, and they get one dose of an anti-MRSA drug immediately prior to the incision. Studies have shown now that approach has dropped MRSA surgical infections in people who are carriers by as much as 75-80%. It's made a big difference.
Yeah.
And what we need are ways to identify individuals very easy, high-throughput types of testing, where we can test very quickly for individuals who may carry resistant organisms. And if you do carry resistant organisms, we may be able to decolonize you and remove it. And that's an area of research that has a lot of interest right now. But staying healthy, good hand hygiene, and I think is the best thing that you have to try to protect yourself from picking up resistant organisms in the environment.
Bob in Clay Banks, hi.
Hi, thanks for the show. Two questions. Would charcoal filters screen out antibiotics from our drinking water if it is so contaminated? And what are your thoughts about some of the triple antibiotic creams like Neosporin?
Well, first of all, the filters have no effect on chemicals to speak of. They have a little bit, but not much. They'll filter out some. A charcoal filter will filter out a little bit of antibiotic, but not very much. I wouldn't worry that much about antibiotics in drinking water. The prior caller pointed out very appropriately that drugs that, if you take antibiotics, they're going to end up into the sewage system because you excrete your antibiotics either through the bile into the bowel or into the urinary tract, and you'll urinate them out. So every antibiotic we give you is going to end up in the sewage system. And we do know there's antibiotic residues now in rivers and streams. They're very, 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 very low level. We'd rather not be there, and there's not much we can do about it. And the best we can do about it is eliminate antibiotic use in animal feed and eliminate all the antibiotics we feed to humans. As we use less and less antibiotics, those residues will decline and hopefully get to such low levels you can't even measure them. But that is a source of concern because fish will pick them up, and fish can get infected by resistant organisms. People can maybe get exposed to resistant organisms just by eating fish. So the answer is that filters will reduce antibiotic residue, but that isn't something I'd lose a lot of sleep about. Your question about triple antibiotic ointments is a good question, and triple antibiotic ointments have mainly been shown to help if you have a skin infection with staph, or if you have a large abrasion, and the best thing to do is clean off that abrasion, scrub it vigorously with soap and water, then dab it dry with a clean towel. And if you want to put a little triple antibiotic ointment on it for a day or two until it scabs, once it scabs, you need nothing, and it'll heal fine. There are studies that show for that kind of a thing, giving an antibiotic ointment for a short period of time may help prevent accelerate the healing of it. But I would not use it for a little zit or trivial uses. That's not necessary. For two reasons. One is you may promote resistance. Secondly, you may get a side effect. These drugs commonly cause hypersensitivity or rashes.
Thank you, Bob, very much. The more we talk here, the more I think that we need some kind of huge national education effort in this whole area, and I don't see it happening, Dr. Mackey.
Well, we're a lot further down the road right now in that direction than we were even 10 years ago, and certainly 20 or 30 years ago. And we've been using antibiotics heavily for at least 40 to 50 years in world medicine. And we are moving in the right direction, but you're absolutely right. We need more intensive programs on education. It's extremely important for the public to realize that they should not get an antibiotic unless there's a very clear-cut indication. If you're a healthcare provider wants to give you an antibiotic, ask them, why do you need it? What is the infection they're treating? And if they can't tell you an infection they're treating, just because a fever alone is not a reason for an antibiotic in the outpatient setting. If you have leukemia, we'll treat you when you have fever, because half the time it means you have an infection that's going on. But in the outpatient setting, fever is rarely an indication for antibiotic therapy. Most sinus infections in adults do not need an antibiotic. Most ear infections in older children over the age of 2 do not need an antibiotic. Many skin infections do not need a systemic antibiotic. You might use a topical antibiotic like triple antibiotic ointment or over-the-counter bacitracin, but you don't need an antibiotic if you're healthy and you have low risk, particularly for furuncles. So if an antibiotic is offered it's an appropriate thing. You're not questioning your healthcare providers, your physicians' competence. You're engaging. I like questioning patients. Every patient I see, I send them a copy of my note because I want them to be as informed as possible about their illness, what we're treating, what we're trying to protect them from. The more engaged that we are in our own health care, the better care we're going to get. And so it's always an appropriate thing. And you should ask it about
sure.
any drug.
Well, of course, yeah. You mentioned skin. Here's an email that came in. Can you talk about the use of antibiotics for acne treatment? It's given out like candy.
That's a very good point. And it's become very clear. There's many studies now showing that the germs that cause acne have become increasingly resistant because of the tremendous use of antibiotics in acne. And they're particularly tetracyclines and clindamycin are two drugs that are used very widely. The reality is that antibiotics clearly help acne, but for mild acne, you don't need an antibiotic. You don't need an antibiotic for mild acne. I had three teenage children at one point in time, and when they had a tiny zit, they came and said they wanted an antibiotic for their acne. I couldn't see any acne. I mean, it was just trivial. And I didn't give them an antibiotic, and I explained to them why it was not in their interest of getting an antibiotic. Now, on the other hand, if you have severe acne, it is perfectly appropriate to give antibiotics. The antibiotics we use are a class generally that resistance is not a big issue with other germs. They're not an issue with staph or gram-negative rods or other organisms that cause serious infections. So taking a tetracycline, if you have moderately severe acne, will help it. And there's nothing wrong. That's a clear indication. The problem is minor acne or minimal acne should not be treated with an antibiotic, in my judgment.
This hour, Dr. Dennis Mackey, he is professor of medicine, head of the infectious disease section at the UW Hospital and Clinics report from the World Health Organization surfacing again this week about antibiotic resistance, which is a health concern all over the world, and we are talking about it and what steps need to be taken by the medical community and by individuals to keep this, to address this problem on a world level. Our number, our lines are busy, 800-486-8655, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, we seem to be on a health theme for this Wednesday. New Jersey's state legislature is taking up a bill requiring all public water systems in their state to add fluoride to the supply. Municipalities around the country are pushing back against fluoridation because it can be rather expensive. And there are some communities in Wisconsin that have fluoridated water, others don't. We will look at the key role that many have said it plays in dental health. And we'll have another guest saying public health can be achieved through other means. So we'll look at that issue and how it became an issue in this country, which the history is pretty interesting. Tomorrow at this time period, Senator Russ Feingold will join us. He's always a guest we like to have on the air. He's written a new book, so mark your calendar for that day. Antibiotic resistance. We have had a couple emails coming in, Dr. Mackey, concerning soap, antibacterial triclosan in liquid and bar soap. Should we avoid antibacterial soaps? It's difficult to find soaps without those.
That's a very good question. First of all, there are a number of antiseptics that are quite effective against staph and other gram-negative rods. Triclosan is one of the earliest antiseptics that became available. It got incorporated into hand washing agents back in the 1960s and 70s in the United Kingdom. And it really sort of hit our shores probably 15, 20 years ago. What I find very alarming is that they're putting triclosan in baby toys. They're putting triclosan on countertops. They're putting it into furniture. They're putting it into all kinds of things where we don't need it.
Huh.
And the fear is that that will promote antiseptic resistance. Now, triclosan is an antiseptic. It's important for the listeners to understand that there's a big difference between antiseptics and antibiotics. The best way to think about it, an antibiotic is like a rapier. It inhibits a microorganism by usually inhibiting one enzyme pathway or one gene product. It's very selective. That's why if an organism mutates that gene, they're resistant. Antiseptics are chemicals that will kill organisms, but they may break down whole cell walls. They may inactivate whole protein enzyme systems so that an organism can't just mutate one gene to be resistant to an antiseptic. And examples of antiseptics are alcohol, iodine, triclosan, chlorhexidine, povidone iodine. And there's been almost no resistance seen to antiseptics, very, very little, despite the fact they've been used massively for prevention of infection in hospitals, cleaning the wound, cleaning before surgery, before you put in an IV catheter, before you put in a urinary catheter. We use antiseptics to cleanse the germs off the skin, to remove the germs off the skin. And antiseptics used properly have been shown to have a huge impact. We've discovered that a total body bathing with chlorhexidine once a day in ICU patients cuts the risk of MRSA in half.
Oh, my.
And it's very well tolerated, and there's been virtually no resistance to antiseptics. So we use them widely, being grateful that we have not had resistance. But if we put them in all of these products, they're present in very low concentrations. Low concentrations of any agent are a recipe for resistance occurring. And my fear is that this unwarranted, unnecessary use of antiseptics in commercial products that are used in the community on a massive scale could well lead to resistance to these very, very valuable drugs. If we had resistance to chlorhexidine on a wide scale, or God help us, to alcohol, ethanol that we use for disinfection, we would have serious, serious problems in healthcare.
Why would we put some of this in furniture? What's
it's,
the point?
It's done on the premise it'll give us a marketing plus.
Oh.
You say, well, if your furniture is resistant to staff living on your couch, maybe a person who carries staff, it'll kill it if it gets on the couch.
Ah.
It's going to prevent resistance. Or your baby is not going to, your child's toy isn't going to get staff on it from another child because the surface has got an antiseptic surface. There's not a shred of evidence that these agents make a difference in preventing infection in humans. But there's a lot of intuitive concern that it could promote resistance. So to answer the question, I don't think we should be doing this. I think it's a bad idea, and I don't really know why the Food and Drug Administration hasn't restricted it. As regards soaps, I'm not as troubled about putting antiseptics in soaps, because particularly in hand-washing agents, because MRSA is 3 to 5% of the people carry MRSA. Most of us will pick it up by getting it on our hands, and from our hands it goes to the rest of our body. So if we can be more effective when we do hand hygiene and kill some MRSA that may be on our skin, I'm not as troubled. But it is not, nobody has shown conclusively that it makes a difference except for prevention of diarrheal illness. There's good studies showing that good antiseptic agents, if somebody in the household has diarrhea or there's a lot of diarrhea in the community, that will help prevent the spread of diarrheal illness. So I'm not as troubled about putting triclosan in hand-washing soaps. I don't think we should be putting in everything else.
John in Milwaukee.
There's a type of virus or viruses that attack bacteria. I think they're called antibacterial phages.
I was wondering
how much research funding is going into antibacterial phages.
That's a very good question. I studied bacteriophages when I was at CDC 40 years ago, and we've known about bacteriophages for 60 or 70 years, and they're viruses that are specific for killing bacteria, and the Russians have actually done the most research on using bacteriophage for treating infections. The problem is that the bacteria can become resistant to bacteriophage the same way as they become resistant to antibiotics. Number two, growing up large amounts of a single strain of a bacteriophage is not a trivial undertaking, and you have to purify it. And the problem you have is that for any single bacteriophage, let's say I have a Staph aureus, an MRSA bacteriophage, any single bacteriophage doesn't kill all the MRSA. It'll kill maybe 60 or 70%. If I have 10 different strains of bacteriophage, I'll probably kill most MRSA. And the best success with using bacteriophage has been using combinations of bacteriophage. But they're proteins that are they're very small proteins, and they can be when you put it, inject them in, when they're absorbed or they're injected in the bloodstream, we have enzymes that may break down these very small proteins, and then they are not as effective. It's a very good idea, but the practical considerations in making it work have been formidable, and that's why they have not really gotten to prime time yet.
Well, you've been a whole wealth of information. I can't thank you enough for joining us this hour. It was really important and incredibly informative. Thank you.
Well, I very much appreciate the opportunity. This is an extremely important issue, and the more that the public realizes that they play a very pivotal role in doing something about this, the better.
Yeah.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Oh, our pleasure. Dr. Dennis Mackey, Professor of Medicine, Head of the Infectious Disease Section at UW Hospital and Clinics, addressing the latest World Health Organization warning that antibiotics are becoming increasingly resistant all over the world, and we need to take steps before they are completely ineffective. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing the hour and Katie Madsen for on-air production in Milwaukee. We'll return.